University of the Air. Tonight, the sixth in a series of 10 lectures on contemporary psychiatry, given by Dr. John Lovett Doust. Dr. Lovett Doust is professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto. He's done a great deal of original research in his field and has made psychiatric education a special concern. In his lecture this week about mental retardation, he considers various forms of retardation and their causes, and describes recent medical advances in understanding and preventing the disorder.
In our last lecture, I discussed those psychiatric disorders due to organic causes, and I concluded with a description of dementia. Dementia, as you'll recall, is the term used to denote a dissolution of the mind, especially in regard to its intellectual powers. Today, we're going to talk about mental retardation, actually a very similar condition to dementia, save that it occurs in childhood. Mental retardation is a term introduced rather recently in North America to describe mental deficiency and to replace the sense of shame connected with feeble-mindedness. Since there are many forms of retardation, the term is admittedly euphemistic rather than accurate. Even so, it's infinitely preferable to such ambiguous expressions as handicapped or even exceptional children, which are used in certain centres in the United States. In Great Britain, the terms amentia, mental defect, and oligophrenia, literally a small mind, were current for many years, but they too have now been abandoned. The new British legislation contained in the Mental Health Act of 1959 officially refers to this form of psychiatric disability as subnormality. The World Health Organization, on the other hand, recognizes two terms: mental defect, to refer to children with organic brain damage, and mental retardation in children whose subnormality is the result of some learning disability. However, in this lecture, I shall use these terms interchangeably. What is mental retardation? The answer to this question is not so simple as it might appear, and the difficulty is compounded by the many disciplines involved with it. The law, education, psychology, sociology, and psychiatry all are concerned with one or other aspect of mental retardation, and each attempts to emphasize its own point of view in seeking a definition. For our purposes today, I shall err on the side of simplicity and define mental retardation as a condition of subnormal mental development which is present at birth or from an early age and is characterized chiefly by limited intelligence. Mental development refers to the child's capacity for emotional adjustment, social adaptation and learning, and the rate at which these capacities progress towards maturity. Intelligence has been defined as the general ability to adapt to new situations by means of purposeful thinking. Since the original work of Binet and Simon in France in 1905, intelligence has been capable of measurement, and the ensuing 60 years have seen a steady improvement in the psychological tests available and in the precision to be expected from their results. Most of the literally dozens of intelligence tests in use today are built on the original Binet-Simon design. That is, they consist of a number of separate subtests, each assessing some aspect of the totality of man's abilities. The scores on each of the subtests are grouped, weighted for their relative contributions, and then summed into a total score. By reference to the scores given by persons of known intelligence levels, the final score is interpretable in terms of the mental age of the subject. Intelligence quotient, or IQ, is derived from this by dividing the mental age by the child's chronological age in years and multiplying by 100. Thus, if Sally's mental age is 12 and her chronological age is also 12, then her IQ is an average one of exactly 100. If, on the other hand, Tommy's mental age is only 6 and his actual age is 12, the same as Sally's, then Tommy's IQ is only 50, and providing that the test has been properly carried out, he's mentally retarded. As a rough guide, intelligence tests yield the following broad groupings. People of average normal intelligence have IQs between 90 and 110. Those whose IQs range between 110 and 140 are of superior intelligence. Those above 140 are geniuses. At the other end of the scale, an IQ between 70 and 90 belongs to the dull and backward, while below 70 are the various degrees of mental subnormality. What must not be overlooked, however, are the implications of the definition of mental retardation I began with today. I said that mental retardation was a condition of subnormal development which is present at birth or from an early age and is characterized chiefly by limited intelligence. Now, these concepts of mental development and intelligence can be picked up by psychological testing, but not necessarily so. The criteria are really social ones. And it's not therefore surprising that we find in our institutions even today children who are undoubtedly retarded, yet who have IQs well within the normal range. This is surely no more surprising than the many stories that we've heard about geniuses who did poorly at school, and yet who went on to prove themselves later as outstanding men and women in their fields. We should perhaps beware of test results of any kind which set themselves up as arbiters of final judgment. They can never replace adequate clinical appraisal and the psychiatrist's human wisdom and experience, but they do represent a tremendous scientific advance as mass screening procedures and as statistically accurate measuring devices. Here's an example of new knowledge which was gained as the result of the introduction of intelligence testing. When the Binet-Simon tests were first administered to seemingly normal public school children in America between 1912 and 1916, the results were alarming in the extreme. The tests revealed that some 2.5% of these children had IQs of 75 or below, and hence qualified for consideration as borderline or distinctly retarded. This discovery hit the USA with surprise and dismay. A new word, morons, the foolish ones, was coined to describe these high-grade defectives, and a new extended concept of mild mental retardation had to be added to the older one of the grosser, self-evident defect states of idiot and imbecile. One practical result of this discovery was the tremendous increase in numbers of patients held in governmental institutions for the retarded, and a consequent change in the pattern of their populations. Hitherto, they had almost exclusively admitted severe examples of mental defect. Now, these hospitals had to open their doors to lesser degrees of retardation. In England, for example, a survey taken before the last war revealed that about half the mentally retarded patients in institutions there were classified as morons, the so-called high-grade defective. After the war, similarly, another survey showed that more than one half of these high-grade defectives in institutions had IQs of over 70. Actually, while still of some use, these older IQ-based classifications, idiot, imbecile, and moron, have now largely been given up, and they've been replaced by the simpler social groupings of mentally subnormal and severely subnormal, the educable and the only trainable varieties of mental retardation. If both these groups are taken together, it's been estimated that between 2 and 3% of the population is mentally retarded. For Canada, this would amount to nearly 500,000 people. So you can see that it represents both a social disability and a national health problem of significant degree. To dub a child mentally retarded tells us nothing about him, of course, save that he's subnormal. Both for the better understanding of the patient himself, and thus of the means of helping him, and also for preventing these conditions in a possibly healthier society for the future, we have to inquire concerning the nature of subnormality and its causes. And broadly, there are two big groupings. We shall look at each of these in turn. Firstly, then, the normal subnormal. This sounds like a contradiction in terms, but actually it isn't. The condition is also known as the physiological or subcultural or aclinical variety of defect. But I'm going to stick by my use of normal subnormal. And let me try and explain what I mean. If you open up a sack of potatoes and measure the sizes of a sample of 50 of these vegetables, you'll find that some are large, some intermediate, and some small. If you plot the sizes on a graph against the frequency of their occurrence, you'll get what's known as a normal distribution curve. The middle-sized average potatoes will be the largest group, and on each side of them, the larger and larger ones will string out to the right of the graph, and the smaller ones, similarly, out to the left. And the further away you get from the center of either side, the smaller will be the numbers of representative potatoes. So that in the end, the distribution curve will look like a bell. Now, what applies to the size of potatoes also applies to eggs and tomatoes in nature, and in man, to eye and hair color, to muscle size, to height and weight, athletic ability, and of course, to the distribution of intelligence in children. So, for no other cause than that implied by the normal distribution curve, we can expect a few subnormals on one side of every 100 average normals born, and a few supernormals on the other. And just as these supernormals will be, for the most part, only people of bright intelligence, rather than geniuses, so will the subnormals, for the most part, be morons, rather than severely retarded defectives. The basis of this sort of expectation is genetic, with the tendency of parents of poor quality genetic endowment to breed true and to produce offspring with similarly poor quality genes. Certainly, twin studies suggest that if one uniovular, that is, single egg twin, shows this type of normal subnormality, there's a much greater likelihood that the other twin will also show the same sort of defect than is the case in fraternal or two-egg twins. And so important is this that a recent investigation suggests that 3/4 of the variation in IQ come about as a result of genetic inheritance. Let's take a brief glance at one of these normally subnormal high-grade defectives, a girl we'll call Sophie. Sophie's 19 now, and I've observed her and tried to help with her problems for the past 5 years. She was born in the slum area of a big city, of honest but poor working-class parents. Neither parent had had much education, but both were simple, well-meaning, good-living folk. And Sophie was the third of 6 children. Her birth was normal, but it seemed to take her longer than usual to achieve her milestones of toilet training, sitting, standing, walking and talking. By the age of 3, it was evident that she was backward. But because her brothers and sisters were themselves somewhat retarded, it wasn't obvious to the family. It became so, however, when Sophie began school at 6, and she couldn't keep up with the rest of her schoolmates. She failed grade 2, was placed in a special class in grade 3, and from then on was moved up at irregular intervals, not really graduating from any grade. She was seen by a psychologist from the school adjustment service, and was found to have an IQ of just under 70. That is, too high for transfer to a special school for the retarded, and so she carried on in public school. She was poor in most subjects, but especially so in arithmetic. She was quite a behaviour problem in class, being bored quickly and up to all kinds of mischief. Physically, she was developing quickly, and she entered puberty at an age 3 years ahead of her classmates. When she was 15, she was found to be pregnant, and she left school to have the baby. Child was taken up by the Children's Aid Society and put up for adoption, and Sophie began a series of jobs. She found rapidly she couldn't keep office positions of any kind, and one post she got, that of a telephonist receptionist, nearly drove her to distraction before she quit after a couple of weeks. The routines of an assembly line factory worker or of a hotel maid, however, and the more glamorous job as a waitress in a short-order restaurant appealed to her and were within her capacity. New learning and complex techniques remained difficult for Sophie, and she was poor at thinking and planning ahead. Socially, people tended to take advantage of her, and at the age of 19, she was pregnant for a second time. Although on this occasion, the magic word marriage had been mentioned by the boyfriend. The second big group of causes of mental retardation is the medical one. By and large, these produce fewer cases than the genetic variation group, but they're more serious and tend to fall into the severely subnormal category of mental retardation. These medical causes may operate anywhere along the history of the affected child, from defects in the sperm or the ovum, or in the union of them, which gives rise to the embryo, to the embedding of the embryo in the wall of the mother's womb and its growth in the womb during the 9 long months of pregnancy. From the hazardous hours-long process of birth to the several dangerous days involved in the perinatal period immediately before, during, and after the actual birth itself. And lastly, the delicate years of infancy and early childhood, when infection or injury, disease or deformity can come about at that time in the child's life when he's least well able to withstand it. Now, I can't hope to mention all these medical causes. What I shall try and do instead is to provide an example of each of the epochs in the procreation and development of the young child as an illustration of what may go wrong to produce mental subnormality in it. And I'll begin with troubles in the generative cells of the parents. Actually, there's seldom anything wrong with these cells themselves. The mischief arises in the submicroscopic genetic materials the cells contain. Normally, the nucleus of each cell contains 46 minute rod-like structures called chromosomes, of which 44 are called autosomes and 2 sex chromosomes. Suitable cells, when specially prepared and stained after tissue culture growth, readily reveal their chromosome structure and number under the microscope. Counts can be made and the different shapes of certain of these chromosomes identified. The sex chromosomes, which ultimately will determine the sex in the offspring, are especially easy to identify: a female cell possessing 2 so-called X chromosomes and a male cell 1X and 1Y. Other things being equal, the union of a sperm and an ovum following sexual intercourse has a 50-50 chance of forming a fertilized cell of 46 chromosomes, either with an XY sex chromosome combination, in which a male child is conceived, or one with an XX combination, in which case the child will be a female. Now, chromosomes are important principally because they are the carriers of ultra-microscopic combinations of complex chemical substances called genes. And it's these genes that determine the patterns of our inheritance and provide the building blocks of our constitution and our personality. Everything we inherit from our parents and forefathers is represented in the molecular configuration of these chemicals, from the size of our brains to the hair on the back of our hands, from the color of our eyes to our likelihood to develop certain diseases, from the potential to become a musical genius or one of a wide variety of types of mental deficiency. I promised you some examples. The complicated chromosomal evolution of the sex cell can lead to the following kinds of difficulty, all of which are associated with mental retardation. It's been discovered quite recently that chromosomes can break into 2 or more pieces. And this will give the microscopic appearance of 47 or more chromosomes instead of the normal 46. And then again, one of the pieces of a fractured chromosome may attach itself to another chromosome, thereby interfering with the function of both of them. This is technically known as translocation. Sometimes again, the tissue of an individual is found to contain 2 or more different types of cells. A proportion, for example, with 45 chromosomes and the rest with 46. And this is known as mosaicism. Klinefelter's syndrome illustrates some of these points. This is a disease affecting males. They have small testicles, big breasts, 47 chromosomes, the extra one being an X or female sex chromosome, and mental deficiency. And the similar condition in the female is known as Turner's syndrome. In both of these conditions, it's the sex chromosomes which are at fault. But any of the other chromosomes, or autosomes as we called them earlier, can be the seat of complications. Far and away the commonest example of trouble in the autosomes is mongolism, which is actually a form of retardation due usually to 47 chromosomes with autosome number 21, the seat of the anomaly. Before we leave the cell as a cause of mental retardation, I should like to mention one other example of the sort of way it can be involved. We've spoken of the chromosomes, but not yet much about the genes attached to the chromosomes. PK disease is a useful shorthand for phenylketonuria, a form of often severe subnormality which occurs usually in fair-haired, blue-eyed children. It can be detected by a simple chemical test of the urine, now routinely carried out in most Canadian hospital maternity wards. It's due to the absence of a specific gene, actually a chemical enzyme or catalyst, which normally enables a particular product of food protein to be broken down in the body. In phenylketonuria, this product, phenylalanine, accumulates abnormally and interferes with the early development of the brain and hence gives rise to mental deficiency. To know exactly what's gone wrong is the first step towards being able to do something about it. PK disease today is one of the few forms of retardation which can be prevented if not cured. For a diet freed from phenylalanine and administered for the first few years of the child's life has been shown to be effective in keeping him mentally normal. Let's now turn from the genes and the chromosomes to the types of mental defect resulting from environmental causes. And first, the womb, the environment of the fetus. The example I should like to mention here is the effect of a virus infection in the mother on her unborn child. Mumps, influenza, and especially rubella, or German measles, are dangerous indeed when they infect a pregnant woman in the first 3 months of her pregnancy. If the fetus doesn't die, it may well be born deformed, with cataracts, deafness, congenital heart disease, and mental defect as legacies of the infection. Following the child's development on, the process of his passage through the birth canal can be a hazard of which subnormality may be an outcome. Disproportion, prolonged labor, mechanical injury to the brain and fetal skull are some causes. Bleeding into the brain, fetal asphyxia, maternal toxemia are others. If the child survives, epilepsy, cerebral palsy, and mental retardation are a few of the consequences. As to the factors which can act later on during infancy and early childhood, these are legion. The one I've singled out for mention is hydrocephalus, literally water on the brain. As its name suggests, this is a condition in which the cerebrospinal fluid, which circulates normally between brain and spinal cord, damages the brain by sheer pressure and progressively destroys it. There are many causes of hydrocephalus, from a congenital malformation of the head to production of scar tissue following inflammation of the brain coverings from an infection. In internal hydrocephalus, the pressure is solely on the brain, and the danger is death rather than deficiency. In external hydrocephalus, the fluid presses as well upon the inside of the skull, and the head starts gradually to expand. If neglected, huge, frightening, and grotesque heads can result, along with progressive retardation. Fortunately, recent advances in neurosurgery have made hydrocephalus a treatable condition, and we seldom see today the pathetic, hopeless human vegetables and their huge heads, which were all too common in the past. Actually, there's a growing list of causes of mental retardation which can be prevented, reversed, or cured, like kernicterus. This is the severe jaundice of the newborn due to the presence of the Rh factor in blood. and it's well known to most people. But the exchange transfusion used to treat it is quite new. Another condition is cretinism, due to the failure of functioning of the infant's thyroid gland. This endocrine gland is situated in the neck, and for one reason or another, can fail to produce enough thyroid hormone. And when this happens, the child fails to grow properly. So a cretin is always a dwarf in stature. But he's also a mental dwarf, for his brain is similarly stunted. The administration of thyroid extract at any time in the child's life will help him grow up physically, but the thyroid has to be given very early in infancy if it's going to prevent the mental deficiency. Lastly, a word about a very special sort of subnormality, which is not really mental retardation at all, although it behaves like it. And I refer to the effect of deprivation on the intelligence of the child. So much of our perceived world is dependent upon the accuracy of our sense organs that impairment of vision or of hearing can and often does make learning so difficult that it replicates retardation. The change evoked by the simple provision of glasses or a hearing aid in sensorily impaired children can sometimes be dramatic. Muscular difficulties and specialized disabilities affecting reading, writing, and speaking can produce similar simulated retardation, as can also the social isolation of the child. And these factors, when recognized, can often be treated and can result in the loss of much, if not all, the apparent retardation. Mental retardation was once the ill-nourished, unattractive offspring of psychiatry. Today, it's a burgeoning and vigorous specialty of medicine. Time hasn't permitted us to do more than take a series of brief glimpses at its present situation. But it's probably accurate to say that mental retardation of all clinical specialties has benefited most from the surging recent advances in basic medical sciences. Biochemistry, genetics, neuropathology, to mention just a few. True, we can still only train and educate rather than reverse and cure, but we are learning fast about how to prevent the occurrence of subnormality. And even cure itself is not an impossible dream for the future, as work on means of inducing regeneration of nervous tissues gets underway. Next day, we shall examine the bridge between organic and the psychological aspect of medicine and review some psychosomatic diseases.
Dr. John Lovett Dust, with the 6th of 10 lectures on contemporary psychiatry. Dr. Lovett Dust is professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto, director of the Clinical Investigations Unit at the Ontario Hospital in Toronto, and consultant in psychiatric research to the province of Ontario. He's the author of more than 50 scientific papers on his original research. Many of the programs heard on University of the Air are available in book form. 3 new titles have just been published and can now be purchased from the publications branch of the CBC. They're The Ultimate Science by Brian Hawking, Why the Weather by Stuart Marshall, and The Scientific Revolution by W.E.K. Middleton. To obtain a copy of these or any of the University of the Air books, write to the Publications Branch, CBC, Box 500, Terminal A, Toronto. This is the CBC Radio Network.